This is the Author Archive podcast. Now, in this episode, a new book. Gareth E. Reese has written a book called Sunken Lands. Welcome, Gareth. Is this referencing myths like Noah's Ark, or is it more of a look at the history and geography of Sunken Lands?
Well, it's unusual in the sense that what I like to do is take the myth and take the landscape and the history and blend them all together. So I'm not really an historian. I'm more of a sort of what you would call a psychogeographer or a mythogeographer. I like to travel through places and kind of connect with my imagination and also the folklore and mythology of the place.
So where did this start? Where were you one day and you saw something or felt something or heard something and you thought, oh yeah.
Well, it really began with my first book, which was the origin of this book, which was called Marshland. And I lived next to the Hackney Marshes and I just started walking there with my dog. And I think I discovered what I would describe as a lost mythological realm in the middle of London. I started to hear stories of headless bears and crocodiles lurking on the banks and realised there was a rich folklore in this urban edgeland. So a lot of my work has been really about that sort of seam of imagination and fantasy and folklore in everyday places. For this book, it was really, I live in Hastings, so I'm very, very close to a sunken land. There's a beach called Pett Level, about 10 minutes drive away, and that is a lost forest, appears at low tide. So this is a place that's fascinated me for the last 10 years. I've been living here, and it's appeared in a few of my other stories and books. And it really, during the pandemic, when my children were running over the bones of a dead Mesolithic forest at low tide, in the middle of this kind of great transformation in the world, I began to think about the connection between now and the deep past in which people would have gone through radical and sudden change in their environment. And that's what gave me the idea for this particular book.
And you're there with a dog called Hendrix, which I totally approve of. And and your two little girls, who are probably bigger girls now. And when you're at this place that David Bowie went to, what do you see that proves that this is a sunken land?
When you go there, you see really dead trees. You see logs and bits of branch everywhere. There are stumps coming out of the sand. It's a bit like a magic eye painting. So I think someone who just went to Pett Level and looked across the shingle towards France would kind of at first just think it was a kind of muddy, rocky beach. But actually, most of what you see is mud is actually old peat. And in the when you get closer, you begin to see that there's just wood everywhere. And within the wood are kind of little holes from hiddocks, which are a type of sea creature that live in within them. You realize there's all these old cycles of kind of ecology that are happening on this beach because of this ancient forest that was once populated, would have been a place for hunting. And they found various bits of spear and evidence of fires. So there was obviously people living there during the Mesolithic and the Neolithic periods. And you can see evidence of this. And it's a continually changing landscape because the sand is scoured and changed and piled back on. So it's a changing landscape, which is why I think David Bowie chose it for his Ashes to Ashes video, because it's a sort of place of transformation and change, which much like Bowie was going through at the time.
And there's a little bit in your book where you say before your girls were born, you knew there were challenges. But since you became a dad, and dads of daughters go through this thing, and it seemed to bring a piquancy and an urgency to your thought.
Definitely. It definitely changes you having children, and certainly it makes you see the future in a longer way than you're normally used to. And so it takes you out of that selfish short-termism that we tend to be prone to. And I began to think about what they're inheriting. And it since my first daughter was born in 2008, there has been a radical acceleration of these, of extreme weather events and of climate change. So it was like when I first had children, I kind of thought of everything as they would live in the same kind of world that I was living in, and there wouldn't be much difference. However, sort of 10 years on, 12 years on, particularly when the pandemic was happening, I began to see that that might not be the case. And that gave me, an urgency to write a book that would use sort of my powers of imagination and travel writing for kind of a purpose, really, something that would maybe help contribute to storytelling about this event that's happening right now.
When you do this, what's the emotion you feel? Because when I hear certain politicians, I get incandescent with fury. Do you feel this anger at the world we live in?
Yes, and I think that in the book I try, and in a kind of using storytelling rather than polemic or finger wagging to try and show how we have been subject to a campaign of disinformation and prejudice and some propaganda by the powers that be, who want to kind of maintain the status quo and keep the oil burning and keep the fossil fuel industry going. And that makes me very angry, because there's climate change that happens because of certain changes in the environment, and maybe that's inevitable or a side effect of human behavior. But there are other types of climate change that feel like a crime, that feel like an act has been committed against us deliberately, with knowledge of what it is doing to the environment and to our lungs and to our future. And that feels to me that's something that people should be angry about, but they aren't, because I think the story is being controlled by the mainstream media.
That's not a conspiracy theory, is it, Gareth?
No, I mean, if you look around now, there are lawsuits against oil companies all over the place, particularly in the States. This is all, the wheels are turning. People are now accusing some of these companies of ecocide, and I think that story is going to get bigger and bigger. It's not a conspiracy, because there's proof there, but there's advertising campaigns that we've seen from oil companies, particularly, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when they knew they had evidence that it was going to cause climate change from their own researchers. They had adverts that boasted of how much glacier their products could melt in a day.
Yeah, I saw that. But here we are. I mean, we're pre-election in the UK, we're pre-election in the US. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump said that he just wants to drill, drill, drill. Mm-hmm. And here the Tory party seems to be advised that if they want to get more votes, they've got to stop the green stuff. I just mm-hmm. put my head in my hands and I scream. What do you do, Gareth?
I write books about it. I think I felt like I was doom scrolling Twitter and seeing all this kind of terrible news all the time. And I was becoming more and more anxious and helpless. And one of the things that this book is about, really, is about the emotional journey through confronting what's happening from my own point of view as a kind of anxious, neurotic writer and a dad of two young children. But also, I think there's a lot of people who feel the same way, a kind of helplessness and a feeling that the story is not being told in the right way. And I feel that we need to confront what's happening, and we can take back the narrative from these people. I think the best thing we can do to give a sense of agency, I guess, as we, especially if you're a writer or an artist, is to talk about it and bring it out into the open and tell the stories. And that's kind of my microscopic contribution was this book. I wanted to tell a story about Sunken Land's past and present and future, and bring that story together in a way that people would understand without having to think about facts and figures and the stats and the sort of the party politics of it. Just to feel that human story of change, and what do we do when we know that change is happening, and how do we act in a responsible way?
Yeah, the book we're talking about, Sunken Lands by Gareth E. Rees. Your roots are in Wales, Gareth.
I'm a sort of hybrid, half Scottish, half Welsh, born in Germany kid. So I'm a bit of a, I've got roots, family roots are in Wales and Scotland.
Okay. Are there any of these sunken lands around Wales?
So Wales is particularly big in this book. I didn't realize it. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to go to Wrexham, where my grandmother lived, and my great aunts lived in Bangor on Dee, just by it. And I stopped off there on the way to start my Welsh phase of this journey, of this travelogue. And it's a flooded place. I remember it flooding a lot when I was a kid. And my dad has stories about his grandmother sort of avoiding the floods by being hoisted on a chair from his great aunt's house. And I realized as I started to look further into Wales from that point that I knew personally, that it was saturated in flood lore. There's the Lowland Hundred myth in Borth and Cardigan Bay in the West Wales, that whole landscape that was eaten up by the sea in the sort of Mesolithic period. Along the North Wales between Anglesey and Wirral, there's another sunken forest. And most of the lakes in Wales seem to have fabled towns at the bottom of them. And so Lake Balor is an example. And so as I explored, I realized there was mythology everywhere. In fact, in Carnarvon, there's a thing called Merlin's Oak. So the wizard Merlin apparently cursed the town with drowning. And there's been an oak tree in a specific point for centuries, and when it burnt down and was removed, there was all these floods. So there's an interesting overlay of the old myths in Wales still seeming to have some kind of relevance to events now.
And having written this book and immersed yourself in this, how do you feel about myths? I remember a long time ago talking to some Americans who were off to find Noah's Ark, and I thought, no, you're missing the point. It's a story. You can't go and find this thing. It probably didn't exist. What's your view of all of these myths, which you revel in the book?
Well, I love storytelling, and I think stories are a really important way of describing place. So my if anything describes my work, I write about the stories of place as much as I write about the physical geography of a place or the history. And the reason why I think that's important is that's how we communicate messages. That's how where we encode a lot of our cultural messages and understanding are in these stories we tell about place. And there's myths on all sorts of levels. There's the big myths like Noah and Atlantis, and then there's the smaller myths that you have in local areas, you know, just that kind of the rumors and sort of werewolves and big cats and things. I think they're how human beings, it taps into a great Jungian part of our brains. I think that's how humans express their view of the world. And I think there's this great seam of fantasy that I think tells a story and is important for cohesion, for communities. And also, if you think about it, a lot of these myths have endured for a lot longer than probably information on microchips and our sort of feeble databases we'll have now, which can sort of degenerate and disappear. Stories last for thousands of years and they change according to the different cultures that tell them. And I think we're sort of telling a version of those old myths and we're sort of passing it forward. That's something I'm always conscious of in my writing.
And you mentioned Atlantis. What's your view on Atlantis? Was there any fact at the bottom of this?
I feel like that's an impossible one to answer, but it certainly is because of the number of places associated with Atlantis, it's definitely a story that seems to have relevance to old places. So what people seem to do is connect Atlantis to various sunken lands, archaeological sites. And so it feels like the story is like a thing that we attach to this trauma that happened in the deep past. It definitely happened. Whether it happened in one place or multiple places, I don't know. But it feels like something at the end of the Ice Age, sequence of events, has come embedded in most of our Abrahamic religions and folklore. There's over 2,000 global flood myths, and they sort of permeate most of our culture. As I say in the book, we're all children of the flood, really. We all come from that kind of inheritance of this transformation in the early Holocene that we're still kind of undergoing now, and we're seeing a repeat of those events in the kind of rising sea levels and the extreme storms that we're having now.
Do you get fascinated by the people who were there, if there were? I mean, I'm always drawn and find it very moving that these are people just like us. When you travel the globe, you meet people just like us. Do you ever feel this link?
Absolutely. So if you engage your imagination in a lost place and you see that sunken tree or you see that little bit of stone wall from this place that used to be inhabited and you begin to sort of people it in your imagination, it's a really emotionally resonant place. And I was thinking about like how similar people were in the Stone Age. It's more and more evidence shows that they were much more sophisticated than we've been led to believe. And what must have happened to them must have been extraordinary to feel that everything they knew was changing very, very rapidly. And then I went to the southern Louisiana wetlands for the final chapter of the book, where I confronted what was happening then, happening now, to people who were also a community living out in the wetlands, who have had to abandon their homes in Isle de Jean Charles, first climate change refugees in America. And that really resonated with me because it felt like I was seeing the past and the future kind of happening right in front of me in this sort of wetland where the trees are drowning and the waters are rising. And I thought this is kind of what happened in the lowland London and Cardigan Bay and all the other places that I talked about in the mythological or deeply historical places.
And when you went there to Louisiana, what were the people saying? Did they have the big view like you do?
I went around, was given a tour by a woman called Cassandra, who's lived there in New Orleans all her life. And she says it's a strange time because they know that, I think most people there realize that there is only a limited amount of time that the city can survive. And so they're in a very unusual situation. Their long view isn't a long view at all. She said it's almost something that they can't talk about all the time because otherwise it's too bleak. So they're kind of partying. It's a party at the end of the world in sort of New Orleans and that in those parts of Louisiana. But I don't know if anyone has really the long-term view there. I mean, most predictions are going to put it underwater. The flood defences are only going to survive so long. And a lot of people would accuse it of not having the right investment anyway. But there are a lot of places where they're going to have to let it go to the flood. All the wetlands are disappearing, I think, at the rate of a football pitch every couple of hours, which is an astonishing rate of land loss. It's not just sea level rise. It's isostatic pressure. And the isostatic pressure of old ice ages are still kind of rebounding the land. So it's tilting downwards. And you've got these great oil canals that are creating these kind of sort of sluices for water to come in, for storm tides to come in. that's basically sort of hastening the end, and there's not really any way of stopping it, as far as any scientist I've seen talking about it can confirm. So I think it's one of those things where the water's going to come. One of the residents of Isle de Jean Charles said it: "You can't stop the water. The water's going to come."
If the levee breaks, I mean, I do a blues show on Jazz FM, and this is written into the history of the music, but probably only going back 100 years. And there's thought that it will get better, but your perception is, and their perception is, it's not.
Yeah, it's just there's too many forces at work in combination that you can't stop. So there's going to have to be, I think, in the future, some kind of letting go of the land. Interestingly, when you're talking about the blues music, it's fascinating to see what happened in the Mississippi floods in the 1920s, which gave birth to so many different tracks. When I tried to make a playlist, I had so many blues songs, I had to kind of cut it back a bit.
Yeah, well, because it entered the mythology and some great songs. Okay, so that's where you went. Did you do things like the Marshall Islands, which are going underwater now? Did you go to the places that are really on the edge?
No, so I talk about some of these places. So I talk about, for example, the San Blas Islands in the north of Colombia, which I visited in 2003. With this book, I'm not a journalist, and I have a limited budget and time, and I also didn't want to jet around the world, sort of causing the climate change that I'm trying to write about. So what I did was I'd made two very sort of judged trips, one to Italy, to Baia, so I could swim over a sunken ruin, and one to the Louisiana wetlands, just because it was so fast sinking and urgent. There were loads of locations around the planet that I would have, love to have gone. There's lots of islands, Tuvalu and Fiji, the city of Jakarta is sinking and needs to be moved. They would all be places, I guess, if I had a TARDIS and a wish list, I would pop up in. But for this book, I had to limit it to a lot of kind of walking places I could walk.
And a budget, yeah. Tell me about that place where you went swimming and you looked down, and what did you see?
So in the Bay of Naples, just sort of near Mount Vesuvius, there's a kind of a super volcano. So this Vesuvius is actually the younger sibling and the sort of smaller one. And there's this vast volcano. And because of the volcano has a magma chamber, it rises and falls. And there was in the Bay of Naples, it was a Roman party town called Baia, which was their sort of Ibiza party town, Las Vegas, anything goes holiday resort for the wealthiest and most powerful in Rome. And the magma chamber empties sometimes and sometimes fills up. So it actually emptied after the Roman era. And as the empire crumbled, Baia, their party town, pretty much sank, about two thirds of it sank beneath the waves. Then the same forces of magma chamber, it's called bradycism, began to expand again. So it lifted the town up, began to be seen in the 60s and 70s by pilots flying over. So now you can dive there. It's an archaeological park, an underwater park. And so I took the brave step of donning some scuba gear, and as someone who's not dived before, and went out to sort of dive over the ruins, and it's partly what you'd expect, and partly not what you expect. It's not as much like a Roman town as you'd expect. It's kind of lots of walls covered in kelp, and kind of hard to make out until you begin to look. But they found a lot of statues there, and they've replaced the originals with replicas. So as you swim around, you can see sort of Claudius's and Nero's villa with statues in the places that it would have been found.
In this trip that has led to this book, when you're just sitting thinking about what you did, what are the memories? What's the things that you saw that have moved you most?
I feel the whole process was probably the thing that I remember, because going from the kind of end of a pandemic with young kids running around on the beach in the dead forest, and then sort of ending up in a rainstorm in southern Louisiana at the furthest point of Louisiana, looking at the oil wells and the gas refineries, where I actually literally came to the end of the road where the road went to sat, and then was found by sunken trees. I felt like a story had happened to me. Like it happened almost like a novel, and it wasn't really planned that way at all. And that was, I found that really emotional.
What's the message that you'd like your readers to take away?
Things change, and we need to embrace change and move with it. And we need to confront what's happening in our world and tell better stories. We don't need to pummel people with more facts and figures. We need to take back the story about what's happening to our world, and kind of create a new consciousness of what's happening, so that people can change and we can change with it, rather than building more walls and resorting to those kind of measures.
And you worry about the world that your daughters are going to live in for their life. Are you more optimistic than you were?
I'm not more optimistic, but I'm more about, I feel that there's ways that we can all kind of confront and go through grieving processes and then maybe change our world so we can mitigate against the worst. I think it's possible for all of humanity to come and do something that will change the way we live. It's just whether we can grasp that control back from people who just want to keep it as it is and keep kind of burning the oil and create and consuming the forests.
Now, this is just a contentious thought to finish with. Are the right people in charge?
No.
Okay, I'll leave this at that. The book is Sunken Lands, Gareth E. Rees. I found it a splendid read. Thank you very much, Gareth.
Thank you so much for interviewing me. Cheers.